Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, for the record, I'm Ken Masters, representing the appellant, Burian Toyota. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. We are asking the court to reverse and remand for a trial solely on damages. That would also include the question of whether or not this was willful and malicious.
Why do you get a trial on that last issue?
Because the jury verdict form told the jury not to go beyond the question of damages if they came up with a zero, so the jury never got to the willful and malicious.
Was there an instruction or verdict form that would allow them to reach that issue at all in the first trial?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't see how they could go.
If you didn't ask for it in the first trial, why do you get a second opportunity?
Because let's begin with the error. The error is that the jury instruction doesn't properly state the law on damages. If that is an error, okay, if you agree with us that jury instruction doesn't comply with Petters, then there's a presumption of prejudice from that. I'm trying to answer.
Well, let me just assume we accept all that.
Okay.
Why don't you get the trial you'd have had with the correct instruction on the elements?
That's what we're asking for.
And that trial would not have included asking the jury to make the finding that's a predicate for getting fees, because none of the instructions.
Yes, it would have. Yes, it would have, Your Honor.
Well, that was my question to you. What instruction would have, or what verdict form would have given the court the finding required for attorney's fees?
The verdict form that they signed. Right after the question, do you find damages? That question says, were they damaged? Okay, so was there a trade secret? Was there a misappropriation? The next question is, do you find damages? Question four. And then it says, if you say zero, go to the end and sign. The very next question is, was it willful and malicious? So they were not allowed under the jury verdict form to reach the question. So if there's harmful error from that question, and from that jury instruction, that's why we believe we'd still get. That question simply hasn't been answered yet, hasn't been before the jury.
Let me take you to the question of whether the instructions valid the standard we apply. Why wouldn't we just look at, could you argue your theory of the case, and why couldn't you argue your theory of the case when you piece together how all this stuff works?
Under the legal challenge we're making, there are three things. We don't believe we could argue our theory of case, and I'll explain that. But we also, if you misstate the law or you mislead the jury on the law, those are also legal grounds for overturning a jury verdict. So those are our three grounds. Why couldn't we argue our theory of the case? Our theory of the case was all we have to do under Petters and under the restatement of unfair competition is show sales. That's what they literally say, and that's what the restatement says, and that's been the law since 1888 all over the country.
In this case, there a difference between sales and damages from sales that 12 lay people sitting in the box would understand?
Well, since the jury is presumed to follow the jury instructions, yes. 18 defines damage. Let me make sure I look at it so I'm quoting it. So it says the plaintiff has the initial burden of proving damages from sales. Damages means the amount of money that will reasonably and fairly compensate Burian Toyota for any injury that you find that was proximately caused. So that definition, that's the only definition of damages in the jury instructions. Presumably the jury follows that. And it says that we don't just have to show sales, we have to show what would reasonably and fairly compensate us. Any reasonable jury would say, well, that's not just a gross amount of sales that resulted from this. There's the question, did the sale actually result, right, from this? And there's the question, are there discounts to that from the costs of selling the cars? That burden is placed on us by that definition.
So in essence, you're saying this is not harmless error in any sense.
It's harmful. It's harmful. We think, remember that in order to get to the determination that there is a trade secret misappropriation, the jury had to find that this has independent economic value. And yet their answer is $0. That is a conflict between what they determine. Now, are there ways they can get there? Sure. And if we have a fair trial with good jury instructions, could the jury still say zero? Of course they could. We don't believe they will. We think that they will say, yes, you were damaged. This is about the clearest example of a trade secret misappropriation I've ever seen. Mr. Butler admitted he took a list from us with 500 to 1,000 names of our clients and uploaded it with the permission of the owner and the general manager and other managers at Larson Toyota. I mean, this is absolutely clear. I think it's also willful and malicious, and I think we can prove that at trial if the jury gets a chance to answer that question.
Was there a fact dispute? Wasn't there a fact dispute at trial about what was on the list that he actually took, and does that make a difference, and how do we resolve that if we need to on this record?
Well, if there's a factual dispute about it, then you would, of course, have to have a challenge to that and a record on which to make it. Otherwise, the jury's decision is the law of the case, and you don't have a record here on which you could examine anything in the cross appeal. So I don't think, though, I mean, Mr. Butler testified that it had 500 to 1,000 names of our clients on it, so I don't think there was any dispute about that. And we put in a declaration on the summary judgment for Mr. Dillon, that's at 548, that says we compared the sales lists.
Now, you say you put in a declaration. Is that the trial testimony?
No, it's not the trial testimony.
Was
no,
that what we're talking about being interested in here?
Well, I'm just saying that in the record there is evidence that we did this and a sworn statement that we made this comparison. Whether the jury would accept that testimony or not is for the jury. It's a question of fact. You just remand for a trial on that question. You can't obviously resolve a fact question like that. Here, all we're saying is there's a presumption of prejudice if that jury instruction is wrong on the law. In order to overcome that, they'd have to show harmless error, which I believe they would have to bring a record to you in order to establish harmless error. So I don't even see how you reach harmless error on this record, because they brought you nothing. But it isn't harmless because it misstates the law in Petters. So if there are no further questions, I would ask you to reverse and remand for the trial on damages and to award us attorney's fees on appeal, and I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Suzanne Michael on behalf of the respondent, Robert Larson Motors. I would like to start by backing up a little bit and talking about what the Sobel list is. The Sobel list is a list of customers that David Butler sold automobiles to and or sold shoes when he worked at Nordstrom. It is simply like pages out of a phone book where it has names, addresses, and phone numbers. I believe it's admitted by the other side, Your Honor.
Or is the Sobel list, is the Sobel list the entire direct marketing information maintained by Sobel on behalf of Perry and Toyota for everybody?
The Sobel list is simply a list that each salesperson, if they opt to use Mr. Sobel's services, Mr. Sobel will send them, for example, a Christmas card in the name of David Butler or something like that. It has no proprietary information on it. It doesn't have Social Security numbers or what these people bought from David Butler.
Names get added to the Sobel list over the years of the salesman's tenure at the company?
They do, Judge, yes. And many salespeople bring their lists. Obviously, the automotive industry is quite portable. And salespeople bring their lists, and they are frequently uploaded into databases. And in Robert Larson, other lists have been uploaded as well. But let me back up a little bit. Here's the problem that I believe the appellant has that I think should be pretty clear. They are claiming that under Petters, you simply have to establish sales. There is a list, and Robert Larson Automotive Group as a whole, which has 14 automobile dealerships, made some sales. Not because of David Butler, not because of the list.
But you left a piece out. They also have to find that that list is a trade secret.
That is true. They did have to find that, and obviously we dispute that. But even
there something, once you've taken something from somebody that the jury finds has independent economic value and proprietary and important threshold crossed?
No, Judge, and here's why. You have to establish under the WPI, under the restatement, under Petters, that there's a proximate cause of damages to the plaintiff from the taking of this list. This is different than Petters, which is a piece of, essentially, it's technology. And if this technology generates something, we know that this technology is responsible for the loss of income to the person who owned the trade secret.
Well, isn't that exactly what the plaintiff is saying they didn't get the chance to do, because the instruction required not just proof that the availability of this list produced a sale, but that it also caused damage to the plaintiff, and the plaintiff had to quantify the amount of that damage?
No, Judge. They are skipping the piece of proximate cause. They are simply saying that a list was taken, Robert Larson Automotive Group sold vehicles to people in our database. They could be in the database for thousands of reasons. These databases kept by these auto dealers essentially the same people in the database. For example, if you want to buy a Toyota or a Porsche or a Volkswagen, you go online and you shop around. And every auto dealer in the Pacific Northwest gets this hit that you are looking for a 1988 Toyota Highlander, for example. So your name is now in every auto dealer's database. And so what Burien Toyota tried to argue to this jury is that simply because David Butler took a list and from that list some sales were made, therefore, ergo, there's damage. But they had
that really an argument that it isn't really a trade secret? Didn't the jury go against you on that question?
It isn't that, Judge. Even if it was a trade secret, they have to establish under the restatement and under the WPI that there was a proximate cause of damages. From the taking of the list, there is a proximate cause of damages. What if he had taken the list and put it in his back pocket? And then there are sales made at Robert Larson, who also happen to be people in the database at Burien Toyota and Dachshund Toyota, and you name the Toyota dealerships. All of these people have the same people in their database.
Well, let me ask you a more basic question. Do you admit that this jury instruction is inconsistent with the WPI?
Absolutely not, Judge. And in fact,
why not?
Here is what Judge Lum did that was actually brilliant. Instead of saying they simply had to establish sales, which would be inaccurate, they have to establish a proximate cause of sales because of the list. And so Judge Lum wanted to make sure that he cured the issue by saying there have to be damages to Burien Toyota from sales by Robert Larson.
And is that justification that you just gave in the record before us?
I believe it is, Judge, yes. Obviously, that is why Judge Lum went to great pains, because he understood the difference of this case versus Petters.
Which you have a problem with the fact that Instruction 18 defined damages? I mean, you've made one argument, and that is that you have to show there's a causal relationship between possession of the trade secret and the sale that your client accomplishes. And that, we can agree, is the law. But the definition of damages that was given to the jury describes something different than sales proximately caused by use of the trade secret. It described economic harm to Burien Toyota proximately caused by the trade, which means another step. Not only do they have to prove that the trade secret was used to procure the sale, but that if your client hadn't used the trade secret, they would have achieved a sale, because that's what's required to prove that they were damaged by the person not buying the car. So you've imposed, by use of this definition, the loss of an opportunity to prove simply that use of the trade secret resulted in a sale to your client.
I think, Judge, that's two steps further out. You have to go back to the issue of proximate cause simply because there is a list.
Well, then, what's the point of the second part of the Petters standard? Why then say then the burden of proving sales, then the burden shifts to the other side to establish any portion of the sales not attributable to the trade secret? Isn't that the proximate cause you're stating? Isn't that the burden?
If they had established a proximate cause between any sale of any kind, then it would be our burden to establish, exactly as Judge Leach indicated, that they wouldn't have bought the car from them anyway, and or that they wouldn't have made as much money. So, for example, let's assume that they were able to establish that a sale occurred as a result of the list, and that we made $15,000 on the sale. I would then have the obligation to come forward and say, well, we did sell the car for $15,000, but they would have only sold it for $12,000. We have these outstanding salespeople and plus net profit. It would have then been my burden to establish that $15,000 was not their measure of damages.
But that's the latter part. That's expenses to be deducted in determining net profits. The first part is any portion of the sale is not attributable to the trade secret. It doesn't that isn't that exactly what you're saying? They have the burden to prove that there are sales attributable to the trade secret, and then the burden shifts to you to prove there are not sales attributable?
They have to prove proximate cause. They can't simply say because there is a list and sales are out there and they are made, the list is responsible for the sales. There was no connection between the list and the sales. And let me be more clear about that. They said, first of all, that 219 cars were sold by Robert Larson in this two-year period. And they said of those 219, these are 219, and they are in our database. These people are in our database for whatever reason. Maybe they bought a license plate cover. Maybe they went on a website. They're shopping around. They could be in anybody's database. We don't know. They're in our database. 217 cars are sold by Robert Larson. Not just Toyotas, Porsches, Volkswagens, you name it. Any car from anybody in their database that was sold by anybody at any Robert Larson auto dealership, they said, there are sales. And we said, wait a minute. There's no indication that David Butler or the list played any role of any kind in any of these sales. And so there were five people on their 219. And the reason there is a lie to the 219 is some of those people bought cars after or before David Butler even left. They had bought cars at Robert Larson. So the jury heard that evidence. More importantly, of the 207 people, only five of them had any connection to David Butler. And we brought those people in to testify for the jury. They didn't even know David Butler worked at Robert Larson.
Of course, we don't have any of that evidence in front of us.
I would love to be able to supplement the record. If the court thinks that is important, I would love to supplement the record.
To do that, a couple of steps back, to use your phrase.
Pardon?
Don't you have to, if you want the record considered by this court, aren't you supposed to bring it before you come and hear the questions we're interested in?
I apologize, Judge. I frankly thought that damages from sales under this case and these facts would be very clearly the proper standard. I do.
You made a strategic decision not to spend your client's money on a record because you thought you could win without.
No, Judge, I did not. That's I would.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I just got a couple of things. Obviously, proximate cause is a question of fact for the jury. All we're asking is to get a chance to put the evidence on. But I think Your Honor put your finger right on it. The standard is we have to show sales. They have to show that those sales were not attributable. That you did in the last 5 minutes here an awful lot of stuff that's not in this record, and I will not go tit for tat because it's not in the record. I will just say, for the record, we don't agree with the representations that were made. By the way, in terms of a question of was there a harm here or was there a cause, Mr. Butler testified at page 650 to 52 that he called every person on the Sobel list. That's 650 to 52. He called everyone on the list. He testified right before that there's 500 to 1,000 names of our clients on that list. So if you have any doubts that we can show proximate cause, we can do it. We've got the goods. We just didn't get there. The jury just didn't get there because and due respect to the judge, he made this decision to give this instruction overnight. He gave it to us the first thing in the morning. I will tell you, in the whole time I've been doing appeals, I've never seen a more precise objection than this. This is just a rifle shot objection. You can't say damages, sales, that damages from sales. So,
did the court respond in any way that it was an attempt to blend in proximate cause?
There's nothing in the record that says that. I don't know where that's coming from. You can certainly look at the record, right? There were two colloquies. We've cited them to you. They're very interesting. I think the judge clearly understood what we were saying. He just didn't agree with us. And that's really the question for you. Is this the law or isn't it? I think if you affirm this jury instruction, Petters is undermined. Oh, and I want to just quickly talk. Why is this rule? Why were you right when you said Petters is the law? Okay, look, in order to get and I think you know this, but in order to get a trade secret violation, you've got to show it's got independent value. You've got to show that it was, you know, improperly taken, right? So once the jury gets to this question of damages, that you've already established they did something wrong, they took your list, and it has independent economic value. It is difficult, then, to prove what are the actual damages. And you heard some of that here today. You know, gosh, it's so difficult to do this. Well, between the person who we know the jury found misappropriated trade secret and us, who should bear the more difficult burden on proving these? That's why this rule has developed the way it has for hundreds of years, is that if you have to put a difficult burden of proof on somebody, you put it on the innocent victim of the trade secret misappropriation, not on the person who stole the trade secret. You put it on the person who stole it, not the innocent victim. So in conclusion, I would ask that you reverse remand for a trial solely on damages and on the question of willful and malicious, because they didn't get to that. And I would ask that you say in your opinion that if we prevail, we would be entitled to fees for this appeal, because I believe that's appropriate under the standard. We're entitled to fees on appeal. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all.